A Monday night massacre? A Tuesday night Supreme Court pick? It's all the news 6 ways to Sunday on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Neil Gorsuch is President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. What kind of confirmation battle can we expect in the Senate?
At the beginning of one of these, you don't know exactly what all of the vetting and the attention that's going to be turned his way will turn up. But I think the Democrats will put up a big fight, but I'm not sure they want to go to the mat.
Plus, conservatives by definition abhor executive power. What's the view from the right on Trump's actions?
The executive order on regulatory reform is a pretty significant executive order, but it sort of escaped scrutiny either by friend or foe because they were too busy arguing about how many people stood in front of the Washington Monument.
And we remember an Illinois governor who tried to sell an open Senate seat to the highest bidder and ended up in prison.
I am not guilty of any criminal wrongdoing. I intend to stay on the job, and I will fight this thing every step of the way. I will fight until I take my last breath.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 164 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. How many times have you heard this expression in the last few days?
That was called the Saturday Night Massacre.
The Saturday Night Massacre.
The Saturday Night Massacre.
The firing on Monday evening of Acting Attorney General Sally Yates by President Trump because she refused to defend his executive order on immigration has drawn countless comparisons to the Watergate scandal that ultimately took down Richard Nixon. The Saturday Night Massacre referred to the decision by the Nixon administration in 1973 to fire Special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox. Nixon instructed his attorney general, Elliot Richardson, to do it. He resigned in protest. Then the task went to Richardson's deputy, William Ruckelshaus. He refused and was fired. Ultimately, Nixon went to the Solicitor General at the time, Robert Bork, who did the firing. Whether the Yates matter is comparable to Watergate is debatable, but there is no question that it has become a political football, with opponents of Trump calling her a hero for standing up for the Constitution and the law of the land. But not everyone agreed. Alan Dershowitz, a professor emeritus at Harvard Law School, said on CNN that what Yates did smacked of politics.
Well, Sally Yates is a terrific public servant, but I think she's made a serious mistake here. This is a holdover heroism. It's so easy to be a heroine when you're not appointed by this president, when you're on the other side. She made a serious mistake. I think what she should have done is done a nuanced analysis of what parts of the order are constitutional, what parts are in violation of the statute, what parts are perfectly lawful. There is also a distinction between what's constitutional, what's statutorily prohibited, what's bad policy, this is very bad policy,
yeah,
but what's lawful. And I think by lumping all of them together, she has made a political decision rather than a legal one.
Stephen Miller went further. He's the Trump senior policy advisor who's thought to have formulated the new White House order that called for the ban of immigrants from 7 mostly Muslim nations. Here he is on Fox News.
Tonight we found out that an Obama appointee who was confirmed in 2015, was refusing to enforce the president's immigration order, defend the president's immigration order, and thus refusing to defend the Constitution and refusing to defend the country. It was a betrayal of her office, and she's being replaced with somebody who will enforce the laws of the United States. What's unprecedented here is that the Justice Department would refuse to defend a lawful federal order for political reasons. That is dangerous to our constitutional system.
It's worth noting about Yates' Senate confirmation in 2015, there's a delicious irony here, as this conversation from her confirmation hearing shows. It's between Yates and Republican Senator Jeff Sessions, who's slated to become the next Attorney General.
You have to watch out because people will be asking you to do things you just need to say no about. Do you think the Attorney General has a responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper? A lot of people have defended the Lynch nomination, for example, by saying, well, he appoints somebody who's going to execute his views. What's wrong with that? But if the views the president wants to execute are unlawful, should the attorney general or the deputy attorney general say no?
Senator, I believe that the attorney general or the deputy attorney general has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president.
That was from 2015. The White House executive order announced by President Trump last Friday reportedly came as a shock to members of his cabinet. The New York Times reported that General John Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security, learned about it while he was on a conference call with the White House and looked up at the TV and saw Trump signing the order. Kelly has since said he was informed about it. And the Associated Press reported that General Jim Mattis, the new Secretary of Defense, is also furious with the lack of consultation. And so why not this for our weekly trivia question? What cabinet member resigned the earliest in his or her time in the job? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
If I gave you time to change my mind, I'd find a way just to leave the past behind. Knowing that you lie straight-faced while I cry, still I'll look to find a reason to believe.
On Tuesday night, President Trump announced his nomination to fill the Supreme Court seat left vacant by the death last year of Antonin Scalia.
Today, I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court.
Well, I'm not sure what that's he just said, but Gorsuch is an appeals court judge for the 10th Circuit in Denver. He's thought to share many of the same conservative principles as Scalia, who died last February.
Judge Gorsuch has outstanding legal skills, a brilliant mind, tremendous discipline, and has earned bipartisan support. When he was nominated to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, he was confirmed by the Senate unanimously. Also, that's unanimous. Can you believe that nowadays with what's going on? Does that happen anymore? Does it happen? I think it's going to happen, maybe again.
For his part, Gorsuch said he was ready for the task.
As this process now moves to the Senate, I look forward to speaking with members from both sides of the aisle, to answering their questions and to hearing their concerns. I consider the United States Senate the greatest deliberative body in the world, and I respect the important role the Constitution affords it in the confirmation of our judges.
Robert Barnes covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post and joins us to talk about the new pick. Robert, it's great to have you back, and tell us more about Neil Gorsuch.
Well, thanks. It's good to be here. As you say, he is a conservative judge. He is known as a very good writer in legal writing circles. He sort of carries everything that you think of sometimes when you think of a Supreme Court nominee. His family has longtime Republican politics, firmly rooted in Colorado. His mother was the first woman to head the Environmental Protection Agency. He went to Georgetown Prep here in Washington and then to Columbia University, to Harvard Law School, where he was in the same class as President Obama. He has a doctorate from Oxford. He really sort of checks all the boxes, including working for the Bush administration Justice Department for a short time before he became a judge.
Donald Trump sold Donald Trump as this outsider in this field of insiders, but Gorsuch was not one of those outsiders. He seemed to be the perfect establishment, although conservative, but an establishment choice almost in any time, and maybe perhaps in any other political time, almost a safe choice.
I think that's right. I think that with this first choice for the court, maybe his only choice, we never know with the Supreme Court nominations, he did play it quite fairly safe. But you know what he got from it was something that has been rare in this short Trump presidency so far, which is unanimous support from Republicans and from the conservative legal establishment, too. That has been in short supply in the kind of combative rollout of the Trump administration. And this is one that Republicans were happy to rally around.
And it sounds like, at least ideologically, he sounds very close to Scalia. So, in other words, we'll talk about Merrick Garland in a second, but going from Antonin Scalia to Neil Gorsuch, it seems like there's no real leap there.
I think that's right. You sort of went from the Scalia, the sort of bombastic Scalia we all knew, to the sort of genial version, a young and much younger version of the same thing. Both are originalists. That means that they say that they try to interpret the Constitution based on the words, what the words meant when the founders wrote it. They both talk a lot about textualism, which means looking closely at the statute in front of them, not what Congress intended or how people have interpreted, but what does it say? In many ways, they are quite similar. Gorsuch, after Scalia's death last year, wrote and delivered a long speech about the late justice and how he had influenced his way of thinking about judging.
You know, I think of back in the 69 and 70 when Richard Nixon named first Clement Haynsworth and then Harold Carswell to the court. It seemed like almost they were like in-your-face appointments because he was just angry at the Senate or angry at the opposition. Trump didn't do that. Trump did just pick somebody who, if you didn't know, it almost seems like Trump used the same words, in effect, as Barack Obama did when he named Merrick Garland, who was also well-liked and well-respected by both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, a little bit. Trump had other alternatives. The other finalists were William Pryor, a judge from Alabama, who was quite controversial because of his stand on abortion, and he would have been a real fight to get through. And he also looked at Judge Thomas Hardiman. Interestingly, he serves on the Third Circuit in Philadelphia, along with Trump's sister, who is a judge on that circuit and who reportedly recommended him. But Trump went the other way and went for what was seen, I think, to be sort of a safer and more known quality. I would differentiate a little bit. While Gorsuch was approved easily to when he was confirmed as a judge, I think that he is identified as much more conservative in ideology than Garland was considered liberal in his ideology. Garland was seen as a little bit more of a moderate. I don't think that Gorsuch is seen by anyone as a moderate, but they certainly bring the same kind of credentials as you were talking about.
Democrats, I saw Jeff Merkley of Oregon. He's among the people who said we're going to talk about a filibuster against him. And right now, the filibuster is still theoretically in effect for a Supreme Court justice. But the opposition by the Democrats, even if it's all the Democrats, how much of it is it about ideology and how much of it is it about Merrick Garland?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that are coming into play here. There is a legitimate concern about his ideology. He's very conservative, and he's only 49 years old, so you think he's got probably 3 decades to serve on the Supreme Court if current trends continue. But, you know, there are 2 other things. Democrats are still quite upset about the Merrick Garland situation. They think that this is a seat that was stolen by the Republican Senate. That's what they say, the word they use all the time, and should have been filled by President Obama. And also, you know, there is a real pressure from the Democratic base not to cooperate with Donald Trump and the Donald Trump administration. You see that in their cabinet picks and the way they have slowed down that process. And, you know, the Supreme Court is really the ultimate presidential appointment, or at least nomination. And so I think that they're going to face a lot of pressure from their base to not rubber stamp this nomination.
You know, I think back to 1987 when Robert Bork was nominated by President Reagan, and that really split the Senate in two. But that was more about ideology. This seems to be a real anger about everything, about the way Donald Trump treated, you know, the opposition during the campaign, the way the campaign turned out, the election turned out. I mean, it doesn't matter who he would have nominated. It seems like this battle would have gone on.
Yeah, well, it's a, you know, that's what's happened to judicial nominations, especially Supreme Court nominations. A lot of people are worried about that. It's hard to be seen as nonpartisan when each justice now is basically confirmed on a party line vote. That's how it's really been, with a few exceptions, for the last three nominees to the court. And that worries a lot of people. Specifically, it worries Chief Justice John Roberts, who worries about whether the court's opinions will be respected if it's just seen as, you know, another partisan branch of government.
If memory serves, I think Scalia was confirmed with only three negative votes. Is that possible?
I think that that certainly is possible, maybe even fewer. Justice Ginsburg also, you know, she had been the legal director for the ACLU, and her views were very well known, and she was practically a unanimous pick. In fact, she keeps the key to her chambers on a keychain that she got from Strom Thurmond, who voted for her confirmation. So things have changed incredibly.
Basically, in a sense, you're swapping Antonin Scalia for Neil Gorsuch. But the next vacancy on the court, even if it's, especially if it's like, for example, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a Trump administration, that I would assume would be World War III.
I think it will, too. I think any if there is a second opening for President Trump to fill, I think it will be a huge battle. You know, part of this whole process, as I wrote in a story, the Trump administration and the outside groups that were helping them were keeping one eye on Justice Kennedy. They wanted to make sure that this was a process that didn't offend him. Some even say privately that they wanted this process to make him feel comfortable about the Trump administration, because there is a lot of talk that Justice Kennedy might be thinking of retiring, and that this is a way to say, go ahead, you know, it won't be someone crazy. It will be someone you like. Now, you know, wishful thinking probably a little bit on the part of the conservatives. And as one of his former clerks told me, he will be looking at the whole of the Trump administration if he's making that kind of decision, not just who was appointed for this seat. But Kennedy was absolutely in the back of their minds as they went forward with this selection.
Trump and other Republicans have said that either way, whether a simple majority or 60 votes, either way, Gorsuch gets confirmed. One, do you agree with that? And two, how do you think it's going to be? Do you think it's going to be with the invoking the nuclear option or not?
Well, you know, we're just starting the process. And so while an awful lot is known about Gorsuch, probably not everything is known. So, you know, at the beginning of one of these, you don't know exactly what all of the vetting and the attention that's going to be turned his way will turn up. But, you know, assuming that there's not something like that, I think the Democrats will put up a big fight, but I'm not sure they want to go to the mat. They point out, and this is true, that the most recent nominees, even though it has been fairly partisan, have still gotten 60 votes, more than 60 votes, and that's all it takes to overcome a filibuster. So they say, don't think of it as, you know, one of these filibusters where someone stands on the Senate floor for days at a time, but think about it as, we want someone that's going to be put on the Supreme Court to be acceptable enough to everyone that they should be able to get at least 60 votes from the Senate.
Robert Barnes covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. Robert, I know it's been a crazy day. Thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Well, I can't promise that I'll spend a day with you. I can't promise that I'll find a way with you. I can't promise, no, I can't promise that I'll love you. I'd like to get to know you.
Yes, I do.
Yes, I'd like to get to know you.
Before you.
I'd like to get to
know you.
When Barack Obama was president, if you can remember that far back, he would sometimes resort to issuing executive orders, going around Congress to implement government policy. He did this, he said, because of Republican obstructionism, that the GOP lawmakers refused to act on matters he said were critical. Here he is with an executive order on immigration in November of 2014.
There are actions I have the legal authority to take as president, the same kinds of actions taken by Democratic and Republican presidents before me. that will help make our immigration system more fair and more just.
And here's one on guns in January of 2016.
And the constant excuses for inaction no longer do. No longer suffice. That's why we're here today. So the gun lobby may be holding Congress hostage right now, but they cannot hold America hostage. We do not have to accept this carnage as the price of freedom.
This was all too much for Donald Trump, who often on the campaign trail last year criticized Obama's penchant for executive orders.
And now Obama, he's got so little respect for the Republican leaders that he just goes along and signs executive orders for everything. No, it's all executive orders because that's easy to do. I'll tell you the one good thing about an executive order is that the new president come and with just a signature, they're all gone. Okay, that's good. That's good. And they're gone.
But now, as president, Donald Trump has changed many aspects of Obama policy with his own executive orders on the oil pipelines, on trade deals, on ending the Affordable Care Act, on admitting refugees into the country, on having his strategist Steve Bannon be part of the National Security Council in just over a week as president. Much of what he has done is stuff he promised to do. It's not exactly a surprise that he hit the ground running. But the proposed ban on entry into the U.S. by people from seven, mostly Muslim, nations has resulted in worldwide protests and consternation at home, not only by the left, but by Republicans as well. Here's Arizona's John McCain on CBS's Face the Nation.
Lumping Iraq with Iran, right now we have several thousand Americans who are fighting in Iraq against ISIS alongside Iraqi military men and women. The Battle of Mosul has taken an enormous toll on the Iraqi military. Is Iraq the same as Iran is? Of course not. So it's been a very confusing process. I'm glad that it's a pause. But for us to, we've got to understand the ramifications of this kind of action.
And here's Mitch McConnell on ABC's This Week.
Look, the president has a lot of latitude to try to secure the country. And I'm not going to make a blanket criticism of this effort. However, I think it's important to remember, as I said, a lot of Muslims are our best sources in the war against terror.
David Keene is the Washington Times opinion editor and the former head of the NRA and the American Conservative Union. David, it's great having you back on the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You've heard Republican doubts and misgivings about this new immigration travel policy. How do you see it?
Well, I think you can argue it round or square. There is no question that in issuing the executive order, the administration stumbled a little bit because they don't have their infrastructure in place. They're not as adept at communication or the fine-tuning of programs as they might be a month from now or 60 days from now. That's not particularly unusual. What struck me, though, is the reaction to all of this as if, how could he do something like this? We don't think it's a good idea. Well, this is, in fact, as you noted, something that he said he was going to do before he was elected. And one of the most interesting things that I've seen since the election is the shock that so many have had that this president seems to want to do what he said he was going to do. And, you know, in this country, we have, at least in this city, a sort of unspoken acceptance of the fact that campaigns are campaigns and governing is governing. And sure, the candidate said that during the campaign, but we don't really expect him to do that now that he's been sworn in. Donald Trump, unusually in many ways, is trying, whether he does it successfully or not is a different question, but he's trying to do exactly what he told voters he was going to do when he was running for office.
Although you can make the case, or maybe you can't, but maybe you can make the case that when he went to the CIA on the first day, he sounded like he was still campaigning by talking about the stolen votes from, you know, the Hillary Clinton illegal votes and the size of crowds and the kind of silly stuff that one would think he would have gotten past by now.
Yeah, you know, I'm sort of struck by all this. I don't know Donald Trump personally, and I've watched all this, and as you have. And at the one level, everybody's arguing over these questions about the sizes of crowds and things of that sort, which in the great scheme of things mean virtually nothing. And one wonders whether he's doing that by accident or stimulating that argument on purpose so that he can accomplish the things he wants to accomplish essentially under the radar, because everybody's arguing about things that don't matter. The executive order, for example, on regulatory reform, in which he's going to require that every new regulation must be accompanied by eliminating two other regulations after a year, is a pretty significant executive order, but has sort of escaped scrutiny either by friend or foe because they were too busy arguing about how many people stood in front of the Washington Monument.
You know, I agree with you. I think maybe Sally Yates was the only person surprised by what Donald Trump was doing. I think you're absolutely right. He's doing what he said he would do. But here's another thing that surprises me. Or maybe it means more than what we're hearing. When he talked about the reason he lost the popular vote was because perhaps 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. And people could say, well, maybe that's Donald Trump's ego getting in the way of him, and because of how else would he have lost the popular vote? But could this be maybe even more insidious in saying that the reason that he lost the vote was because of illegal voting, and therefore we need more voter IDs or fewer early voting days, more stringent laws, and to get people to allow to vote?
Well, I think there's a lot of hyperbole on both sides in this whole question about illegal voting. You would think from the reaction to Donald Trump that no illegal vote has ever been cast in this country.
3 to 5 million, though? 3 to 5 million?
Well, I've said there's hyperbole on both sides. For example, the Virginia Dominion University professors who did the study were asked by USA Today to apply the formula they used to determine that in 2008, non-citizen voters accounted perhaps for Barack Obama carrying North Carolina and perhaps for the election of Al Franken in Minnesota, to see whether they would say there were 3 to 5 million such votes cast. They said, oh, no, we can't find, based on our study, that it would be more than 800,000. Well, the question of whether one vote or three votes or 800,000 or 3 million are illegally cast is not irrelevant to the understanding and the faith that we have in the framework and structure of the American electoral system. Because when you look at the polls, and both sides may be guilty of stimulating this distrust of the electoral system, but when you look at the polls and a lot of people think that they can't trust the vote counts anymore, then something needs to be done to restore that faith. And perhaps saying that this many people voted illegally or none voted illegally, neither one of those approaches seemed to me to accomplish the goal. You know, I was thinking, Ken, back, if you remember, the Supreme Court decision in Buckley versus Valeo, the campaign finance case many years ago that upheld contribution limits in political elections. The court found in that case that there was no empirical evidence to suggest that larger contributions corrupted the system. But even absent any empirical evidence, the perception was that it was corrupting the system, and the perception of whether the system was honest was so important that core freedoms could in fact be restricted in order to correct that perception. When you look at the question of voter ID laws and you look at the question of faith in the electoral system, if you apply that logic, then the perception that there's a problem may be sufficient to suggest that perhaps we need to do something to correct that perception.
Well, then how about this? And then how about those people who said, well, let's look into the Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin election results after 2016, and Jill Stein had that lawsuit and everything, and the Republican officials in those three states threw them out, saying there's no reason to do that because the vote seemed fine to us.
That's right. And I didn't say that either party was guiltless in this regard. And obviously each party, whether it's the outcome in an individual election, whether it's redistricting, whether it's whether you like or don't like the Electoral College, all of these decisions are made not on the basis of principle, but on the basis of momentary advantage. And the fact is that the public has become more and more cynical. So I think it's necessary to at least look at ways of reestablishing faith in the system. And if that requires, at one point I was, unfortunately, too many people get too much information or what passes for information off the internet. But at one point, some of these people were arguing even that the old argument that that the dead used to vote in Chicago was just an urban myth. The fact is that elections have been decided by illegal votes, not presidential elections, but certainly local elections, state elections, and the like. And we know that as a fact. That doesn't mean there's massive voter fraud. It does mean that we need to watch these kinds of things. And whether there's 100,000 or 10,000 or a million or whatever the number is, it seems to me that looking at the ways to keep the electoral count honest is an important part of maintaining the infrastructure of a functioning democracy.
Yeah, I was going to say, remember Landslide Lyndon in 1948?
That's right. I mean, or the promise to John Kennedy from Chicago, don't worry, you're going to be able to carry Illinois with a little help from your friends.
<You know? laughs> David, you mentioned earlier in your remarks that both sides were at fault. What I read about Illinois in 1960 was that the Republicans stole as many votes in the southern part of Illinois as Daley stole in Chicago.
Well, unfortunately, most of the folks that were there at the time thought that, in fact, it may have been in some ways Nixon's greatest moment, because everyone around him, including Everett Dirksen, the senator, believed they had the evidence in Chicago that the election had been stolen. And Nixon said that even if that evidence was convincing, it would not be good for the United States and for the people's faith in the electoral system for him to challenge it. And he refused to challenge it. Now, maybe later on he thought, that wasn't such a good decision.
What was I thinking?
In 1960.
Let me go back to the executive orders for one second. I mean, Obama said over and over again that the reason he had to do it is because the Republican obstructionists and all that. Donald Trump has a Republican Congress. There's nobody. So why does he? It just feels like he had the option of going to Congress with some of the things he didn't. And I just wonder if he's going to is going to be a do-it-alone kind of president.
Well, I hope not. We don't know the answer to that question at this point. We do know that there are pitched battles going on in Congress. We now have the opposition party to the president walking out rather than vote in some of the committees on his cabinet members. We all have all of that going on. But it would seem to me that one thing that we need to hope for is that we have a return to the sense where the president of the United States knows what he can and should do on his own and what he should submit to the Congress. To Trump's credit, some of what he's doing, and I'm sure he sees it, all of this is part of the same thing, but Obama did this on immigration, I'll reverse and do the things that I want in immigration. I think that what they need to do is look at it and sort of retract some of the executive orders that were an overreach, but not commit the same sin themselves by overreaching. They should work with the Congress, particularly they have a Congress that ultimately is going to do most of what the president wants. They're not going to get everything they want. No president ever has, even when the president's controlled both houses of the Congress. So this president can't expect that either. But I think what we need as a country for this system to function is for the players in the system to agree in their own minds that they need to play the role they're supposed to play and not a role that they aren't supposed to play. One of the problems with the Obama administration, and every president tries to reach for more power. That's one of the things that the founders expected. The founders, however, thought that the tensions and the jealousies of the different branches would keep that in check. What Mr. Obama did as president is realize that you can do pretty much what you want, because they don't really have a way, if you stick with your guns, to rein you in. And it's always a danger that the steps that one president takes in pushing the envelope will become the floor for the actions of the next president. I think what's needed, whether it's Donald Trump or whoever, is to scale that back. We need to go back to a time, if it's at all possible, where the players in this system understand their role.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, when you think of Republicans in Congress, I mean, the conservatives, for example, never liked the idea of a strong executive. They liked the separation of powers and the ability of Congress to make decisions. What kind of role do you think, you're talking about the kind of role of the opposition, but what kind of role do you see the John McCains, the Jeff Flakes, the Ben Sasses of the world in keeping Donald Trump in check?
Well, I don't think it's, obviously in your own party, you're going to have disagreements with members of your own party on different things. In many of these cases, I don't want to be cynical about, particularly about Senator McCain, but the public and this administration, the president as a candidate, was very clear in terms of the foreign and defense policies that he wants to pursue. Senator McCain doesn't like those defense policies and wants to change them. That's his right as a senator to fight for that. I don't see that as an argument about keeping a president in check. It's more an argument about, I want you to do what I want you to do and not what you said you were going to do.
Can I ask you one final question? This is a question I didn't think I'd ask you, but do you have any sympathy at all for Democrats who, when you hear like Orrin Hatch saying, well, Neil Gorsuch is so highly qualified and so respected, and the Democrats say, well, remember Merrick Garland. Do you have any sympathy for the Democrats who just felt that this seat was taken from them unfairly?
I don't think the seat was theirs to be taken unfairly. It was, as you know, Ken, at that stage of a president's term, it's very different than at the beginning of the term. If Garland had been appointed in the first days, as Sotomayor and Kagan were, there was not much problem in confirming him. When you get to the point where you've got an election coming up where it's a swing in the court, if I were Merrick Garland, I'd feel badly about it. But the reality of politics and the reality of the timing is that this was a situation in which the president and his supporters in Congress wanted to change the balance on the court. And the Republicans, who felt that they had at least an opportunity to win within a very short period of time, wanted to prevent that. So whether you feel sorry for him or not doesn't really affect the fact that that's the way it happened. That's the way it works. And it would have worked the other way under a reverse of circumstances.
So sort of like what happened to Abe Fortas in 68.
You got it.
Johnson nominated him when his term was almost over.
When you look at it, you know, we always get upset that everybody's fighting with everybody. But let's think about it. The stakes are very high. And it is the direction of the country. I'm not talking just about the court. But people feel very strongly on some of these things. And they should feel strongly. There are real differences between the parties. There are real differences among some Republicans in the president. And there are going to be fights within his own party because he is not, strictly speaking, a traditional conservative or traditional Republican. But people have a right, if they're elected to public office and make promises, and I'm not talking just about the president, but of members of Congress and the Senate as well, they should be expected to stand up for their principles. And sometimes they win and sometimes they lose. And I'm always much happier when my side wins. But I understand what it's like to lose as well.
David, do you realize that you and I have never fought with each other?
Well, I don't spend my time fighting with folks.
David Keene is the opinion editor of the Washington Times and the former head of the American Conservative Union. David, it's always wonderful to hear from you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now I don't know where I'm going. All I know to do is hit the ground running. Hit the ground running. Hit the ground running. Hit the ground running.
It's time for This Week in Political History. The election of Barack Obama as President of the United States in 2008 was a joyous moment for the Democrats around the country, and especially in the senator's home state of Illinois. But how they squandered that in the land of Lincoln has become a remarkable story. Let's start at the beginning. With Obama leaving his Senate seat to assume the presidency, the job of filling his replacement fell to the governor, Democrat Rod Blagojevich. While usually such an action is all about politics, this seemed to be about money and greed. On December 9, 2008, Blagojevich was arrested, charged with soliciting bribes, in effect trying to sell the Senate seat to the highest bidder. That led to his impeachment by the Illinois State House on January 9, 2009. And then on January 29, 8 years ago this week, he was convicted in the state Senate on a unanimous vote and removed from office. Rick Pearson is the chief political reporter for the Chicago Tribune and knows a thing or two about political corruption in the state. He's seen his share of Pauls go to prison. Rick, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks very much, Ken.
We know that other Illinois governors, Otto Kerner, Dan Walker, George Ryan, among others, they all went to jail. But there's something incredible about the Rod Blagojevich story.
Well, unlike the others, I mean, with Rod Blagojevich, and during his 6 years as Illinois governor, this was almost just a constant political circus. Blagojevich worked to try to circumvent past Democrats in the legislature, his own party. He was always trying to promote himself into something bigger and better. And basically, the final blow when, after the federal government made its arrest, he had no friends in Springfield. He had no friends at the Capitol at all. It was that 6 years of distrust and manipulation that resulted in that 59-0 Senate vote that removed him from office.
Now, what was his reputation like before this whole thing started, before Obama won the presidency? I mean, it also, there was some questionable conduct, wasn't there?
Yes, indeed. I mean, there was a federal investigation going on even before he was reelected. The U.S. Attorney's Office announced that it was investigating endemic irregularities in hiring, basically favoritism, circumventing hiring rules, and had told the U.S. state attorney to back off while the federal government was conducting its probe. So you already had kind of a hot-button governorship going right at that point. But certainly, you know, when you take the combination of Illinois kind of rejoicing in Barack Obama's victory, and then only, you know, just days later after the victory, finding out that here's these allegations that the governor of the state is trying to peddle Obama's Senate seat for personal gain, it became kind of an instant way for critics of Obama to say, see, he's from Illinois, look what we're getting here in the White House.
Well, of course, Obama wasn't connected to Blagojevich or the scandal, but others were, including some of the people who wanted to get that appointment to the Senate, such as people like Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr.
Sure. You had Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., who later went to prison on unrelated charges. There were allegations that some businessmen had offered Blagojevich large amounts of money for his campaign or for himself if he made Jesse Jackson that appointment. In some of these tapes that the federal government did in its investigation, there were references through the incoming White House transition team then, with Rahm Emanuel heading up the transition, now the city's mayor, but Emanuel leaving Congress to join Obama. There were signals there that Obama would welcome senior aide Valerie Jarrett to become the U.S. senator. But then those abruptly went away, and it wasn't much longer after that that that's when the federal government showed up at Blagojevich's doorstep and arrested him.
And just following the arrest, we heard the governor's insistence on his innocence.
I'm here to tell you right off the bat that I am not guilty of any criminal wrongdoing, that I intend to stay on the job, and I will fight this thing every step of the way. I will fight, I will fight, I will fight until I take my last breath. I have done nothing wrong.
Rick, did anybody believe him?
Well, I'm sure there were some. He did have a block of support. He was very much a governor who was into spending and spending on social programs. So, I mean, he did have some support, but truly his job approval rating in Illinois in a Tribune poll was down to like 13% at one point. And he alluded to that in one of those expletive-filled recordings from the FBI. But you heard that. Then he goes on this massive spree of any talk show that will have him to further try to explain his innocence. But he never explains in any detail what exactly he had been doing when he talked about various ways to try to improve himself, his lot in life, his family, looking for ways that perhaps unions supportive of Barack Obama could set up some kind of a foundation that he could run and make money off of, other jobs that he, you know, might want to trade for. And, you know, it was very obvious that it was about a personal motive here, and I think that's what resulted finally after two trials and the verdict that sent him to prison.
Well, even before he went to prison, when he was still after the indictment and all those people who were saying, you must resign, you must resign, he said, I'm not resigning. And then he goes on to appoint someone to the Senate seat anyway.
Yes, then he goes on to appoint Roland Burris, who had been previously a longtime statewide office holder. and names Burris. Burris gladly accepts it. Roland Burris, who was the first African-American elected to statewide office decades ago, and likes to stock titles, as it were. And he gladly accepted the post and resisted calls that he stepped down, and was even brought before legislative committees to testify about whether there had been any improper dealings going on between Blagojevich and Burris even after the fact.
Here's a tape of the appointment of Burris.
I am here to announce my intention to appoint an individual who has unquestioned integrity, extensive experience, and is a wise and distinguished senior statesman of Illinois. This man actually once was an opponent of mine for governor. So I'm here today to announce that I am appointing Roland Burris as the next United States Senator from Illinois.
So let me see if I get this straight. You have a governor under indictment. He's talking about integrity. And poor Roland Burris just stood there. And, I mean, I remember him smiling and accepting the appointment. But, boy, getting an appointment from Rod Blagojevich, I don't know what that's comparable to.
Well, and that's what a lot of Democrats in Illinois said, is that how can you accept this appointment? It's a tainted appointment. There were a variety of efforts as far as the Illinois state government to try to keep him from being seated, but he ultimately met the qualifications to be appointed to the post. But no one was happy by it, no one at all, and particularly Democrats, who saw this as probably an entree to the end of Democrats holding the U.S. Senate seat of their new Democratic president.
Talk for a second about the impeachment trial in the Illinois House. That must have been kind of fun to cover.
It was, and impeachment trial, it's not like a judicial trial. There are certainly political elements as well. But both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, took it very seriously, and testimony went on for hours. And, you know, here again, because it wasn't just necessarily, it was necessarily the arrest and indictment of the governor that triggered the impeachment. It's not like impeachment hadn't been talked quietly before about Blagojevich over his efforts to disregard the legislature. And so you really had a very kind of unanimous bipartisan agreement here. And the scope of the articles of impeachment went beyond just what the federal government outlined in its indictment, but also to various efforts involving state budgeting and state government. I mean, this is a guy that had so little trust that to actually have to sign a state budget bill into law, he was required to sign individual memorandums of understanding with individual legislators committing to actually spending money for programs that he was attaching his name to.
Well, I was listening to a few hours of the debate the other night just because I wanted to get a feel of it. This, I think, was my favorite clip.
Rod Blagojevich, you should be ashamed of yourself, but I won't pretend to think that you feel any. You've already shown us you have none.
That pretty much sums it up, huh?
And that is now new Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza, Democrat from Chicago, and, you know, a one-time colleague of Blagojevich in the legislature. The trial itself in the Senate was something to behold, where you have the Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court presiding over things, and Blagojevich was refusing to testify at his own trial. He ultimately agreed to, on the final day of the trial, spoke for an hour, but refused to do so under oath. So there wasn't any questioning of him as a witness, spoke for 52 minutes, and then hopped on a plane back to Chicago, on a state plane back to Chicago. He wanted to make sure he left Springfield quick enough that he didn't lose the right to fly the plane to get home to Chicago that evening.
And remind us, where is Rod Blagojevich today?
Rod Blagojevich is in prison in Colorado. He was successful of the 18 counts that he was eventually sentenced to. Five were knocked out, dealing technical aspects of trying to sell the Senate seat. But he was sentenced to 14 years. He was resentenced based on the remaining charges against him recently, and the federal court judge maintained the sentence of 14 years.
Rick Pearson is a chief political reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He also hosts a Sunday show on politics on WGN-AM. Rick, thanks a lot for the trip down memory lane.
Thank you, Ken.
It was 8 years ago this week, on January 29th, 2009, when Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, after having been convicted by the state Senate on corruption charges, most notably the charge of trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat, was removed from office. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Honesty is hardly ever heard, and mostly what I need from you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what presidential press secretary served the shortest time in the job? The answer, Gerald Terhorst. A widely respected reporter for the Detroit News, Terhorst became the press secretary to President Gerald Ford, an old friend, on August 9, 1974. But he resigned 1 month later, on September 8th, in protest of Ford's decision to grant a pardon to former President Richard Nixon. And the randomly selected winner is Don Gomes of Torrey, Utah. Don wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
So goodbye, it's been sweet, even though incomplete. So I'll cry just a little, cause I love you so. And I'll die just a little, cause I have to go away.
I thought we'd end the show with our regular monthly conversation with Neil Conan. He's the former host of Talk of the Nation and the host of a new radio program called Truth, Politics, and Power. And boy, is this the time to be talking about truth, politics, and power. Neil Conan, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you, Ken, as always.
Tell me about Truth, Politics, and Power.
It's an exciting new show. We're going to be talking about the intersection of sort of history and politics. Our first show, for example, was on Donald Trump and fascism. Is it fair to use that word? We talked to a new biographer of Adolf Hitler and with Robert Kagan from the Brookings Institution, and people seem to like it.
You know, I mean, we always talk about the benchmark of FDR in the 100 days. Well, this is only 2 weeks. And my goodness, you know, so much has happened, so much is about to happen, so much is going to happen. What are your impressions of the first 2 weeks, Neil?
It's been an absolute blur of a circus between the incompetence of the travel ban rollout, the alternative facts of Kellyanne Conway, one thing after another, the spectacular announcement of the new Supreme Court nominee, all of that. But, you know, particularly the travel ban, you go back to that. I'm not the only one to say it, but from moral beacon to rogue nation in 2 weeks.
You know, I mean, I think of what Donald Trump said during the campaign, of course, the full and complete banning of Muslims. And then the White House is saying, no, it's not about Muslims. It's about these seven countries. But tell me why you pick Iran, Iraq and Yemen and Syria and not Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Pakistan. That seemed kind of odd.
Well, some people point out that Donald Trump has properties in those countries. And I'm not sure that that's it. You know, the rational explanation is that the seven countries named are six places where the authorities in those countries, these are basically a lot of them are failed states, and the authorities in those countries cannot help the United States vet who is coming and whether their papers are genuine and all of that. Then there's Iran, which is an enemy of the Trump administration, if not of the United States. So that's one explanation. The other is people look at that list and say, wait a minute, as you just pointed out, the attackers who hit us on 9/11 came from none right. of those countries, yeah. and none of the countries from which those attackers came, principally Saudi Arabia, it's not on the list.
I also thought it was kind of odd or interesting the fact that, well, maybe more odd is probably the better word, is that it was the directive that was released on a Friday, and then suddenly all these government agencies, the airports around the world, suddenly had to deal with it without getting real true direction. And it also sounds like the members of the cabinet, like John Kelly, the Homeland Security Secretary, didn't know about it until he watched it on television. That doesn't seem as efficient as I would think.
And apparently part of the order was drawn up by members, staffers at the House Judiciary Committee. But of course, they didn't tell the members of the House Judiciary Committee that they were working on it. You know, on the one hand, this should come as no surprise. This is exactly what Donald Trump campaigned on. And either this order or something very like it had to have been expected. However, the way it happened was completely incompetent. And even as we speak, there is still confusion about who's allowed into the country and who isn't. The incompetence is stunning.
Yeah, and it seems like there's no Republican members of Congress have been tipped off in advance. As they said, Kelly and Mattis were apparently blindsided by it. And, you know, I keep thinking of the two Donald Trumps. There's a very strong Donald Trump who will, you know, be very, very forceful and have his executive orders. And then he'll get into his petty insecurities and grievances, like when he went to the CIA on his first day, and he talked about how the media made up the stuff about the intelligence agencies or about the size of the crowds or the illegal votes. And of course, we know what the illegal votes is all about. It's that he lost to Hillary Clinton in the popular vote, and that's just unacceptable to him.
And this is where we get into the, some of the news media is twisting itself in knots. Do you call disprovable statements lies?
Oh, that's a great question.
When he says things repeatedly that are false, is that the equivalent of a lie? And they go to the dictionary definition and says there has to be an intent to deceive. After a while, you know, whether you call any one of these individual things a lie or not, you really have to come to the conclusion that Donald Trump is a liar. He is somebody who goes out of his way to repeat things he knows to be untrue, and he does it all the time. That's the definition of a liar, as far as I'm concerned.
You know something, I know that NPR had a big debate on it with Michael Oreskes talking about what kind of language you're supposed to use. And, of course, during the campaign, the media was very hesitant about using the word falsehoods. Now I see more on the New York Times, you see the word lie appearing more often, more as a declaration rather than a suggestion.
Yeah, they say they're taking it on a case-by-case basis, but the cases are coming pretty quickly.
You know, I keep thinking about the CIA thing, which bugs me the most. I don't know why it does. One, because he said, of course, that the media made up the stuff about his feud with the intelligence agencies when we know he called them, likened them to Nazi Germany. He knows that 3 to 5 million people didn't vote illegally. But of course, how else do you explain the fact that he lost a popular vote? But I wonder, what do you think of this scenario? And I didn't make this up, but I've been thinking about this for a long time, that when you talk about a rigged election, you talk about a fake election and there were illegal votes, it gives the government the idea or the authority or the suggestion that, well, we have to crack down on that. And therefore, maybe more voter IDs, maybe fewer early voting days, more restrictions on the ability to vote. I wonder if that goes hand in hand with that.
I think it goes beyond that, Ken. I think this goes back to Steve Bannon's idea of being a bomb thrower, of dismantling the entire system. When you make these kinds of statements and when you continue to make them even after you're elected as president of the United States and when your press secretary makes them from the White House West Wing, what you're doing is undermining faith not just in democracy but in the government. Donald Trump is undermining faith in the international institutions that have preserved the peace since the Second World War. Things like NATO, which he continues to say is obsolete, contradicting his own Secretary of Defense, among other people. This is deeply disturbing, that what we're going to be returning to is sort of this, you know, global Darwinism, where, you know, each of the strong states tries to carve out its own spheres of influence, and that leads to conflict, and the kind of conflict that Trump apparently thrives on within his own staff. It's early days yet, but we keep hearing reports of, you know, this aide is in, this aide is out. There's confusion about who reports to who and all of this. But apparently Trump thrives in that sort of chaos. But I deeply worry about this idea that we're discrediting the institutions that have served this country so well and have served the world very well.
What did you make of the firing of Sally Yates, though? Because to me, that was not as black and white as some people made it out to be. What do you think?
It was not the Monday night massacre, let's put it that way.
No.
She did make a principled stand. She had to know that by defying the president's order that her job was over. I think her job was probably pretty over anyway. It was just a matter of timing. She has made herself into a hero for the Democratic Party. And so we'll have to see where her career goes from here. I would say at this point, if she wants to, she could probably get a job running for some office somewhere. That'll be interesting to see.
You don't think that's what she was doing, though, do you?
No, I don't. I think she was honestly saying, "This, I can't support this. I have this job now, and so therefore this is the position I have to take." It will result in her getting a huge amount of publicity, and, you know, acting attorneys general don't generally get that sort of thing.
No. You know, before we get to the Neil Gorsuch pick, I was just thinking, though, that, you know, I saw, like, Jeff Merkley, the senator from Oregon, said, well, we're going to have a filibuster against him. And Nancy Pelosi said all the Democrats are going to be united. But I kind of think that there's going to be any kind of restraint on Donald Trump, it's going to have to come from the Republican Party, the McCains, the Jeff Flakes, the Ben Sasses of the world, rather than the Democrats.
And it's interesting, yes, I agree with you. And it remains to be seen whether an opposition within the Republican Party is going to emerge. And, you know, in part that depends on how this goes ahead. I don't think, if getting ahead of ourselves, it's going to emerge on Neil Gorsuch. I think that's going to be, you know, every Republican will vote for him. And whether that's enough to, get him on the Supreme Court remains to be seen. Probably, I suspect. But don't you think it was interesting that Donald Trump told the Senate Republican leadership, if they need to on Gorsuch, they should go nuclear. I'm not sure that's a phrase I want to hear from the president of the United States.
Well, not this president, but you know something? Mitch McConnell was exactly right. 3 years ago, when Harry Reid was sick of the Republican intransigence and said, okay, we're going to invoke the nuclear option on the lesser offices, Mitch McConnell said, you know, it's going to come back to bite you, and it has. Now the Democrats couldn't filibuster any of the cabinet nominees, and if they want to do a filibuster against Gorsuch, Mitch McConnell say, okay, we'll do the nuclear option again, and all you need is a majority vote.
Except, again, what goes around comes around. This is, it's going to be interesting to see what happens there.
One more thing about Neil Gorsuch before we go. I thought it was interesting to watch Orrin Hatch this week talk about how, well, look, they have to vote for him because he's very qualified, he's well-respected and well-liked, which is exactly what the argument was for Merrick Garland.
Indeed, it was. And Democrats will not support Gorsuch, partly because they disagree with him, but partly because of the Merrick Garland thing and this cycle that goes back, at least to Robert Bork, goes on and on and on and gets more and more bitter. And as you say, I suspect before it's all over, the idea that you could filibuster any judicial nominee is going to be gone and dead forever.
You want to stop at Bork, or you want to go back to Abe Fortas and Sherman Adams and Teapot Dome, right?
Yeah, probably. We could easily go back that far, but it has ratcheted up the partisanship, and the bitterness has ratcheted up every single time. And as you look at this nominee, the idea that this is a guy that Donald Trump would nominate makes perfect sense. He's his views are in line with those of Justice Scalia, whom he would replace. The nomination itself is not that much of a surprise. But, because it came after the Merrick Garland thing, because it now looks like there's going to be scorched earth by the Democrats in the Senate and in Congress, not attending the confirmation hearings for some of the cabinet appointees, and forcing the Republicans to change the rules on what constitutes a quorum in the committee, all that sort of stuff. People out in the, normal people don't care about this stuff, but this is scorched earth stuff on Capitol Hill. And it's going to get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that the Gorsuch nomination almost seems like it's business as usual. I think the next Supreme Court nominee, especially if, like, for example, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg left the court or something like that, that would be scorched earth politics, because we could be talking about the future of Roe.
Exactly.
That's our monthly chat with Neil Conan, the former host of Talk of the Nation.
Leave him laughing. That's what I always say, Ken.
Yeah. Listen, the next time we speak to you, it'll be right after President Trump addresses a joint session of Congress. That should be pretty fun.
That should be interesting.
Neil, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ken.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content. and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
But you may feel a little sick. Can you stand up? I do believe it's looking good. That'll keep you going through the show.